It is evident, dear brethren and sisters, from the length of the speech which has been read, that it must occupy an important place in the scheme of Luke's history. He has told us of the beginning of Christian life at Pentecost. He traces for us the Jerusalem ministry, the opposition of Jewish authorities, the arrest of Peter and John. He narrates Peter's defense, and then tells us of the origin of the internal difficulties in the case of Ananias and Sapphira. At the same time, great progress was made, and many that heard these things were added to the Lord. He then has told us in his history how Jewish toleration was established after the imprisonment of the apostles, firstly by their dismissal, and secondly through the council which was accepted, which was given unto them by Gamaliel. And yet, those who knew anything about Christian life in its relation to Judaism in the first century knew that there was a sharp antagonism existing. What was the origin of that antagonism? We shall see before we are through with this book of Acts the reason why Luke traces out this antagonism. It has a particular bearing upon the legal questions that he will discuss in the book. This speech begins, really, the important legal issues. For a question was being decided by the Jewish authorities whether the distinctively characteristic teaching of the apostles concerning Jesus Christ with all its implications should be tolerated by them. And it happened that Stephen, who was a man mighty in the word, as is very evident, who had a power of presentation in his defense, was the one who was arraigned before them. They were visiting the synagogues, of which there were many in Jerusalem, generally devoted to the men from particular districts who visited Jerusalem, a city of those from the province of Asia, or from Achaia, as the case may be, or from Egypt. And Stephen, in one of these defenses, had been disputing and arguing concerning the Christian faith. And so he was brought before the Jewish authorities with certain charges preferred against him. Now, we must try and see, as clearly as we can, what the charges were that were made against him. For it is only by seeing the charges that were made that we shall see, in turn, how Stephen presented his apologia, his defense. Let us look then at the charges which are given at the close of chapter 6. Verse 10 of chapter 6, they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spake. Then they suborned men which said, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God. And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came upon him and caught him and brought him to the council and set up false witnesses. And here there is a remarkable parallel between what happened to the master and to the servant. They set up false witnesses which said, this man ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place, that is the temple, and the law. So the basis of the charge against Stephen was that he had been uttering things which to them were derogatory to temple and to law. And they explained how his contentions were such by saying, we have heard him say that this same Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered us. We've heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and change the customs. So it is quite evident that Stephen had been contending that the practices of the Mosaic law and the worship at the temple were not essential to be acceptable to God. But the time had now come when these things were becoming obsolete. He was, in fact, putting forward what Jesus had said to the woman at Samaria when she asked him to decide the issue as to whether Gerizim or Zion was the place where men ought to worship. Jesus indicated that historically the answer was in favor of the Jews and of Zion, but the hour is coming when neither here nor there, but wherever men may be, those who worship God in spirit and in truth would be acceptable to him, for God seeketh such to worship him. The charge against Jesus that he had said he would destroy this temple and raise it up in 3 days was a perversion of his teaching. He had indeed said, "You destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days," but he spake of the temple of his body. But it would appear that the Jews, in their opposition to Jesus, somehow fused the two statements. For we find there was a haunting fear about them concerning something that would happen in 3 days. For they went to Pilate and said, "This man said, 3 days. In 3 days I will rise again. Therefore make the tomb secure." And with the same sensitiveness, the Jewish authorities saw a danger to the practices in which they had such vested interest. And even though they put aside their vested interest, to a patriotic Jew it would seem indeed that the man who was putting forward such a case as Stephen could only be classed as a renegade and must therefore be arraigned before the authorities. They must have related these charges to the law of blasphemy. So serious did they treat them. But the man must have recognized that just as they had manifested a bitterness and a hatred toward Jesus which had brought him to the cross, so he in his turn must be prepared for a similar manifestation of evil spirit toward him. So he too must be prepared for a like perversion of the application of justice as he stood before these authorities. And therefore, he must present such a case that it is put with all power and cogency in defense of the position that he had maintained, so that he might show that if it were indeed God's purpose that he had been setting forth in his contentions, it might be put before them in such a way that it couldn't be gainsaid. But the man who had such spirit of wisdom and of power had also the quiet confidence and radiance that comes from utter conviction in the truth of what he believed. And they looked upon his face and saw, as it were, the face of an angel. And with such wonder and bewilderment, they must sit and listen for so long a time while Stephen presented his defense. In Smith's Bible Dictionary, now 100 years old or so, Dean Stanley says that there are 12 mistakes in Stephen's defense. Rackham, to whose book we referred in our first address, a book in so many respects excellent, charges Stephen with 15 mistakes. Now this is serious. We might think indeed that it doesn't impugn the inspiration of Scripture or the accuracy of the record, that under such circumstances mistakes might be possible. But we needn't fall back upon that, for every one of these supposed mistakes can be satisfactorily explained. But not only so, in the very explanation of them by the application of the key upon which we have insisted in previous addresses, what appears to be a mistake is seen to have a marked relevance to Stephen's argument, and is indeed vital to it. Now let me sketch to you first of all, briefly, his argument, so that we might get its outline in our minds, so that the outline is not left lost in the multitude of details at which we shall have to look. So he said then, Stephen is speaking against the law and against the temple, clearly indicating that they were not vital, that they hadn't the place now in the purpose of God attached to them by the Jews. How does he meet it? Well, this broadly is his argument. Abraham was called of God, but he was called before the law was given. And since Abraham worshipped God acceptably, the law was not essential in Abraham's case. Joseph and Moses were both rejected, and yet in each case the man was raised up by God as the deliverer of his people. Therefore, their rejection of Jesus was only an extension of the same attitude to God's work that had been manifested by their fathers. And there were all the elements of a similar mistake having been made on their part in the rejection of Jesus. He shows that worship was offered to God in the wilderness before the tabernacle was made. Then the tabernacle was not essential for acceptable worship. He shows that before the temple was built, David offered acceptable service to God. Neither, therefore, was the temple necessary for acceptable service. He reminds them that their fathers had persecuted the prophets, and therefore warns them that their attitude was a persistence in the evil of their fathers' ways. He reminds them, finally, that the law which they acknowledged had not been kept by them, and therefore this persistence on their part was but an exhibition of what was a national trait, their refusal to accept him and his message. Their refusal to accept Jesus and his message was not strange. And so we can see that this speech of Stephen has, as we would expect it to have, a marked relevance to the charges that were made. Just as a lawyer in court making a defense on behalf of a prisoner must needs deal with the charges that were made against the prisoner, otherwise the judge would not permit him to continue, so also Stephen, in making his defense, must present a case that has strictly related to the charges that were made. And we suggest that the very length of it, extended as it must have been in keeping with what has been said about the previous speeches recorded here, it says something for the impassioned power and the ability of the man as he reviews their history. And he makes no mistake. He builds up his argument with unerring skill and traverses the whole range of Old Testament history. We'll then try and follow, and we shall have to be a little hurried and a little compressed in what is said, and we shall have to ask you to attend closely. Let us try then and follow Stephen in a little more detail. Let us take account of the objections that have been made concerning the accuracy of his words and see how, following Luke's method, those objections really become boomerangs against the critical attack. To the second verse then, men, brethren and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Charan. The God of glory, what's the significance of that? The glory was the mark of the manifestation of God and the token of his presence in the midst of his people. When then Stephen describes God as the God of glory, he is saying that the God who revealed himself as living in the midst of his people by his glory was the one who called Abraham. But he lived in Mesopotamia, and it was before even he came to Charan that the call was made to him. So God evidently can call men independently of either residence in the land of Palestine or of worship at the temple. He had said to Abram, "Get thee out of this land into a country that I will show thee." And here we come to the first two objections that are raised against the accuracy of Stephen. We'll quote the words of Rackham. He says, Stephen makes God appear to Abram for the first time in the land of the Chaldeans. That is Ur of the Chaldees, which was sometimes reckoned by the Greeks in Mesopotamia. Genesis is silent about this appearance and makes the first call, the words of which are quoted by Stephen at Haran. Philo and Jesus, however, agree with Stephen, and the earlier appearance is supported by Joshua. But this difficulty is created by making the appearance of God to Abram recorded in Genesis 12 to have occurred after Terah's death. Accepting the AV of Genesis 12:1, "Now the Lord had said to Abram," we are thrown back to the days of Abram in Ur. What was it that made Terah and Abram leave Ur unless there was some divine message? That God had given them a divine message is evident from the fact that it is said through Joshua later that the fathers of Israel were called from beyond the flood, from beyond the Euphrates. "And he came into this land," says Stephen, "wherein ye now dwell, and from thence, and dwelt in Charan, and from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land." Objection 2. Stephen, and Philo agrees, says that Terah died before Abram left Haran. The figures given in Genesis 11:26, 32, and 12:4 would imply that Terah had yet 60 years to live. But that is to mistake the record in Genesis, for Abraham's name comes first, in keeping with the method of Moses. And that's another story, just as we're examining Luke. In keeping with the method of Moses, Abraham's name is given first, before that those of his two brothers. But it doesn't say that he was the oldest. And we've a perfect right to take the figures and say, Terah lived to be 230, and Abram was so old when Terah died, therefore Abram was born when Terah was subtracting the one figure from the other. And there's nothing in Scripture to forbid that, and that Terah therefore had Abram long after the others. In fact, those of you who have read Bunsen's Design Coincidences will know that the disparity in the ages of the generations led to the marriage of one in one generation to the wife in the next, all of which fits in with the differences in the births of the children. The fifth verse, which we so often quote as showing that the Abrahamic promises were not fulfilled, was not spoken in the first instance for the same purpose that we use it, although our use of it is quite legitimate. "He gave him non-inheritance into it, in it, no, not so much as to set his foot on. Yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession and to his seed after him, when he as yet he had no child." In other words, that while Abram came into the land, the covenant of God with Abraham cannot fail. And therefore, God has a purpose with Abraham, which is yet future. And the covenant with Abraham was given before the law, and therefore there is a purpose of God to be developed upon the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, which is not yet realized. Now you'll observe that Luke records the argument, but he never gives the inference. His face required compression, and he leaves it to the wit of the reader, whom he expects to think after him to make the inference at every point where it is required. Verse 6, and God spake on this wise, that his feet should sojourn in a strange land, that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them 400 years. And Rackham says, here's our third mistake. Stephen and Philo, with Genesis 15:13, give 400 years to the time of Israel's bondage. Exodus 12:40 says 430 years. Paul gives the number 430 years. How do we reconcile the 400 and the 430? Quite simply. Thy seed, God said to Abraham, shall sojourn 400 years. And it couldn't, the promise, the purpose thus indicated, couldn't begin till the seed was born. The length of time from the giving of the promises to the giving of the law was 430 years. And therefore the promise was given to Abraham 30 years before Isaac was born. And the difficulty is resolved. The 7th verse says, and the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge. And after that shall they come forth and serve me in this place. Rackham says, Stephen adds to Genesis 15:13-14, and serve me in this place. Words taken from Exodus 3:12, and so understands by the place Palestine and not Mount Sinai as is meant in Exodus. A criticism that is perfectly gratuitous. But let us apply the method that we've already observed. God says to Abram, the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge, and then I'll bring them forth. And then, Stephen deliberately quotes from the words of God to Moses at Horeb, when Moses was told to go down and bring out my people and bring them to this place, and they shall serve me in this place. But why does Stephen quote that reference? His point is that the people, in fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise about their sojourn, were brought out at the time indicated, and in fulfillment of the words to Moses were led to Sinai and there served God. But that was before the law was given. So even the nation of God, says Stephen, offered acceptable service to God before ever the law was given. How then can the law, and how can the tabernacle of a temple, be in themselves of such essential purpose in God's arrangement? There can be worship he's establishing independently of those things. Bring on verse 8. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begat Isaac and circumcised him the 8th day. And Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat the 12 tribes, and the patriarchs moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt. So Abraham had the covenant, and even the rite of circumcision before ever the law. So it is quite evident, just as Jesus had used the argument before in contention with the Jews, that the rite was vital, not because it was of Moses, but because it was of the fathers. And so Stephen says, even this essential aspect has its real roots in the fact of something anterior to the law. And so Joseph was taken into Egypt, and God was with him. And Stephen isn't moralizing just. He's something more important to do than to moralize when he's pleading for his life. Just think of the quickening effect of a man with power of speech and the ability to reason as Stephen had. Is no time merely for moralizing. When he says God was with Joseph in Egypt, than God can be with a man outside the land of Palestine. Before law, or before temple, or before tabernacle. God was with him. And all the time, Stephen is building up his case that there was evidence of divine favor for men, independent of law and independent of tabernacle or temple as a place of worship. He delivered Joseph out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom and made him governor. A rejected man, exalted by God in his overruling providence to favor and to rulership. But rulership where? In the land of Egypt among the Gentiles. And what if there's a parallel in the case of Jesus? What if Jesus, whom they have rejected, should be one of whom it could be said equally with Joseph that God was with him? And what if God had exalted Jesus even to something higher than Pharaoh could exalt Joseph? And what if the divine purpose in connection with the exaltation of Jesus was bound up with Gentiles, just as it was in the case of Joseph? That's the argument that he's bringing out as he traces out this history. And there came a dearth over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction. And even when God's people were thus in dire need, where was it that they found sustenance? Where was it that they found the essential nourishment for life? It was in Egypt. And when was it that they came to know of the exaltation of this brother of theirs whom they sought to destroy? And at the second time, Joseph was made known unto his brethren. And thus it was, in a time of crisis, there was a revelation of the divine way in the exaltation of Joseph. And it may be, says Stephen, that there'll be a second time in the history of the nation, in a time of crisis, when Joseph will be again revealed, or Jesus, to be seen to be the deliverer, exalted as God. And so he traces the parallel. And so Joseph's kindred was made known unto Pharaoh. Then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him, and all his kindred, 75 souls. And Rackham says, here again Stephen's making a mistake. He says, 75 souls. But Genesis 46, 26, Exodus 1, 5, Deuteronomy 10 and 22 all say 70. But another place in the record speaks of 66 souls. Whatever is this man doing, blundering about like that? Didn't he know his history, although he's trying to draw out such inferences from it? He knew his history. And the very computation that he's presenting to them is a part of his argument. For the 66 mentioned once in Genesis includes the 11 sons, Joseph being accepted, and their sons. And Joseph and his two sons and Jacob added makes the 70. But what about the added five? They're the sons of Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born in Egypt. And God includes even those born in Egypt in exile among those who are associated with the purpose of God. And thus, what appears to be a mistake on the part of Stephen, and he wasn't content to just say it, we may be sure, he gives his reason and his argument as we are trying to draw it out in some sort of a feeble way. And therefore, it wasn't these who were thus connected with Palestine and born there, but it was even those who were born outside who were included in the number enumerated in Scripture. And so Jacob went down into Egypt and died, verse 15 says, he and our fathers, and were carried over into Sychem and laid in the sepulchre that Abram brought for a sum of money of the sons of Emah, the father of Shechem. And so we get objection 6. But Joshua tells us that Joseph was buried at Shechem, and in adding his brothers, our fathers, Jacob's 12 sons, Stephen is probably quoting contemporary tradition. It is necessary to notice that in verse 16, and were carried over by the very fact that the Greek includes the pronoun as part of the verb, it's part of the ending of the verb, that we must introduce the plural, and they were carried over in verse 16. And that refers to our fathers. And so Stephen says that our fathers were carried over into Sychem and laid in the sepulchre that Abram bought. But where was Sychem? In Samaria, of all places, the land of these despised and hated and accursed Samaritans. And if there was any virtue at all in connection with the land of Judea, then Stephen says, don't forget, the fathers of the nations were buried in Samaria. There's not the sanctity about the land that you're thinking. And those men are still men in the purpose of God, although they're buried there, even in Samaria. He's got some pungent things to say, which must have stung them as he builds up his case point by point. And the next objection is that Abram didn't buy a sepulchre of the sons of Emoth. Now the answer to this is rather involved, and I don't know whether I can put it over in the short space available, but we do know that Abraham had an altar there. We do know that Jacob recovered the possession of the land by the use of his bow and left it as a special inheritance to Joseph. And the word portion that is used by Jacob in allotting that to Joseph is the very word Sychem. And why did Jacob take the land? Probably because there was some title to it already vested in them. For the fathers were sojourners in the land and never attempted marauding raids like that. And so therefore the inference can be drawn that Jacob did think he had some title to the land, and the probabilities are that Abram did indeed buy the land. So it isn't, after all, something that cannot be reasonably explained. And when the time of the promise drew nigh, which God had sworn to Abram, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. For God blessed the people, and the multiplication was in Egypt. God isn't dependent upon the land of Palestine. He isn't dependent upon the setup upon which the Jews placed such store for the working out of his purpose. Even their forefathers multiplied when they were in Egypt, until another king arose which knew not Joseph. And then came the time of affliction, the time of such oppression that it was an effort to exterminate the people. And then Moses was born. But where was the leader born? In Egypt. Where was he brought up? In Pharaoh's household. Did they think that all the skill that he had could be used by them when he thought that with all the training that had gone to the making of him, he was their leader? No, said Stephen. They rejected him. An objection is raised that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and mighty in words and deeds. But this isn't so serious a difficulty and can easily be answered. And when he was full 40 years old, and another objection is raised, that there's no record of him being 40 years. But there is an expression in Exodus which indicates, so chronologists tell us, that he was 40. We say someone's coming of age and we know at once that they're 21. And the expression is used in the record concerning Moses that indicates that he was 40. He saw one of the Israelites suffering, and he took an action by which he burned his boat. He'd long time been thinking that he was the deliverer. Why such remarkable circumstances in his life, that he should first of all be preserved and then brought up in Pharaoh's house and then equipped with all the skill in military arts and political economy, well, it just seemed as though he was the leader. He supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. And Rackham says, objection 10, the deeper motive, the desire to give deliverance to his people, which is important in the parallel with the Christ. You see, Rackham catches the argument of Stephen and what he's getting at, but he says the desire to give deliverance to his people, which is important to the parallel with Christ, is ascribed to Moses by Philo as well as by Stephen. Exodus is silent on this. What is the answer? Exodus tells us, as Stephen quotes, that the Israelite who strove with his fellow said to Moses, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us?" This shows that Moses' act in slaying the Egyptian was regarded as an indication on his part that he was willing to lead a revolt of the slave people. And it is implicit in that and other statements in the narrative that Moses was contemplating acting as deliverer. And the inference of Stephen is therefore quite legitimate. When he showed himself to the Israelites the next day, and it became evident that what he had done was known, and when it was said, "Who made thee a ruler over us? Wilt thou kill me?" that Moses fled into exile. And what if another leader has gone away from them, as Moses was, to come back and be their deliverer? If there's to be a prophet like unto Moses, what's the parallel in Moses' life that has to come in the life of the deliverer, says Stephen? If the one is rejected at his first appearing, and yet is sent back by God to achieve the work, what's the corollary which comes from your rejection of Jesus? Will God send him back? That is what Stephen is saying to them. And then when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in the bush. So God made of himself one of the most striking revelations in all of Old Testament history. And it was made in and through Moses when he was in exile from his own people. Isn't there a point in that? What is after all, the mightiest manifestation of God has been revealed through Jesus, who has been taken away from them. Rackham's objection 11 concerns a matter of angelology, which we need not go into. So Moses wondered at the sight as he drew near and beheld it, and he heard God saying, "I am the God of the fathers, the God of Abram, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." You remember how that was used by Peter, as we saw the other day, and what the significance of it was, as Luke narrates it. And so here, the one who revealed himself to Moses at Sinai was the one who had further intentions than the Mosaic covenant. And Stephen links the divine claim to be the God of Abraham with that revelation through Moses, and links the antitype with the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. And so he passes in review a little more fully the things that are concerned with Moses: the sending back of the leader whom they had rejected by God, and then he brought them out. Moses brought Israel out after that he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. And if God could preserve his people for 40 years in the wilderness, God's protecting and preserving care was not dependent upon land or upon people. And you'll notice how in this recapitulation from their history, there is a constant hammering home of this point. Stephen isn't basing his case upon one incident. He says, the whole range of our history is eloquent of the fact from which I'm claiming, which I'm stating my case. It's a question of the divine purpose at any time. And if God could do all these things before ever the law was formulated, isn't it within the range of possibility that the law can have run its course and God introduced another dispensation bound up with the antitype of Moses, and therefore, because it was the fulfillment of all the typical features of the law, something that is independent of them? That this is the case is clear, because the argument moves on. This is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you. Stephen said, I'm not dreaming dreams or putting over to you mere speculation. Here's the testimony that there has to be a prophet like unto Moses. There has to be one to come to whom, in whose life there is a parallel with the life of Moses, in whose experiences there is a parallel with the experiences of Moses. And he points the parallel when in verse 38 he says, this is he that was in the church, in the wilderness, with the angel which spake to him in the Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, who received the living oracles to give unto us. He was in the ecclesia, that's the Greek word, he was in the ecclesia, in the wilderness. And the 22nd Psalm says concerning Christ, after his resurrection, I will declare thy name unto my brethren in the midst of the ecclesia. Catch the phrase that he's using here. In the midst of the ecclesia will I give praise unto thee. So as Moses was with the ecclesia there, even the children of Israel, which is called the ecclesia, so the Lord Jesus was in the midst of the ecclesia. And he's tracing out his parallel. There was a divine revelation given to Moses at Sinai when he was in the midst of the ecclesia. There's been a divine revelation which has annulled law and temple and sacrifice by this prophet like unto Moses in the midst of this ecclesia, this church, which has been established as a result of his work. But just as Moses received the living oracles to give them unto us, so through the mediator of the new covenant, Jesus, of whom the psalmist speaks, as we have quoted, has given living oracles unto us, which are the rule of our life, which are the expression of the divine will. You regard that message given through Moses, he says, as being the living voice of God, then you admit the possibility of God revealing himself through a man. Granted, says Stephen, and we claim that there's been another revelation through the prophet, like unto Moses. And so, the basis of the Christian behavior and its attitude to law and temple is claimed by Stephen to be based equally with Israel's worship upon divine sanctions, but sanctions ministered through a higher prophet and a greater mediator than even Moses was. And so he's led his argument onto the fact that it was through a divine revelation that the Christian was claiming to follow the way of life that they formulated. But now he turns to them and says, now look at all your history and don't repeat it. In the wilderness, your father said, make us gods to go back to Egypt. You've always wanted to go back rather than to go forward. Now change your policy and your practice, he says. Don't repeat the folly of your father. They said, let's go back. Now don't go back. Go forward with the revelation, he says. And then verse 42, then God turned and gave them up to the worship of the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets, and he's quoting from Amos. And here we get objections 12 and 13 of Rackham. As it is written in the book of the prophets, O ye house of Israel, have ye so offered to me slain beasts and sacrifices by the space of 40 years? And that was written of a time long after. But the point of the prophecy is that throughout their history they'd manifested such a character. Yea, you took up the tabernacle of Molech and the star of your god Renphan and figures which ye made to worship him. And I will carry you away. And the passage in Amos says beyond Damascus. And Stephen says beyond Babylon. But remember again what we've pointed out so often, that he introduces another quotation and expects us to go to it. And he's quoting now from Jeremiah, where God said he would send them to Babylon. And what's his point in adding the prophecy of Jeremiah to that of Amos, that they would be sent to Babylon? Why, just this, that God called Abram out of Babylon. And because of the behavior of their fathers, God had sent them back to Babylon. Terrible indictment, and a very powerful warning to them. He said, look at your history, and don't perpetuate the folly of your fathers. Our fathers of the tabernacle, of witness in the wilderness. And so before temple, there was tabernacle. Then there was a change from tabernacle to temple. And therefore there can have been another change. And he says in the 45th verse, which also our fathers that came after brought in the tabernacle with Jesus. Jesus. And Jesus, you know, is Joshua. You know that. And in the letter to the Hebrews, written by the man who was listening to Stephen and consenting to his death, says that Jesus didn't give them the inheritance. I'm sure Paul was feeling the force of this argument. And there are stages in men's lives when the force of the argument being seen and it being felt to be unanswerable, the only answer they can give is the throwing of stones. And that's where Saul was just now. But the argument of Stephen won with Saul, and it is Saul himself who repeats these arguments in his letters, particularly in the letter to the Hebrews. But Saul the persecutor becomes Saul the ambassador then. Which also our fathers that came in after brought in with Jesus into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the face of our fathers unto the days of David. But if it was Joshua who led them in, then they didn't receive the inheritance by Moses. And therefore, it wasn't on the basis of the law that they'd have the inheritance, but by something subsequent to the law. Therefore, the law must pass to give something to place to something else upon which the inheritance would be based. And then, after David's day, Solomon built him a house. But that isn't final, because even the prophet contemporary with it says, howbeit the Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands. And the citation is from the 66th chapter of Isaiah, where God says, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you build unto me? For all these things of my hands made, how can you make a house for God out of the materials that he himself has provided? You can only make a house for God out of what you yourself provide, says the prophet. The Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands, says the prophet. Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What house will you build to me, says the Lord, or what is the place of my rest? And the answer of the prophet is that none of these things that God himself has made will do, but to this man will I look, that is of a humble and contrite spirit, and who trembleth at my word. And so Stephen says, even the prophets testify that the dwelling place of God isn't the material edifice, but a structure composed of men and women of the character who are humble and contrite in heart, and who tremble at his word. This is the building that is the finality of the divine purpose, and therefore these things to which you are clinging so closely are only the temporal, the transitional, the typical. And clinging to them, you're losing sight of the reality. And God has laid the foundation in Jesus Christ, and by being humble and contrite and trembling at his word, you yourself can be built into what will be the divine dwelling place. And we must, at this point, postulate a growing murmur of growls and dissentment, with looks of venomous hatred on their faces, which made Stephen realize that to pursue his argument was pointless beyond this stage. And so he turns to indictment. "Ye stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart, ye do always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did, so do ye. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted?" And Rackham finds this 14th objection there. "They crucified the just one of whom the prophets had spoken. They resisted the prophets. They resisted the one of whom the prophets had spoken. They'd received the law by the disposition of angels. And while they'd had great privileges, they hadn't kept it." And Stephen here has a reminiscence of what Jesus had said. On one occasion, he turned the argument back upon themselves. And Jesus said in effect to them, in one of the speeches recorded in John's Gospel, "How can you go on to a fuller revelation when you haven't kept the one you had?" And that is what Stephen is saying here. You received the law by the disposition of angels, and you haven't kept it. How then are your minds and hearts open to go on to a fuller revelation and to receive it? And so Stephen has presented his case, which has ended in such a burning charge. And then they burst down all restraints and take him out to the place of stoning, to be stoned to death. And even there, this man has a final testimony. "Behold, I see the heavens opened, and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God." Well, Jacob had seen the heavens opened, and a possible way of connection between heaven and men. But now Stephen says, "Heaven is open, and the man for whom the link with heaven has been established is there at the right hand of God." Too mighty a claim for them to receive. And with fingers in ears, they rushed him out to the place where they stoned him. And Saul, says Luke, with all the significance of his method of writing his history, and Saul was consenting unto his death. And so we have the account of how the rupture began between Judaism and Christianity, and the grounds upon which Christianity pursued its course, gradually working away from Judaism. And now, I've an apology to make. We do not, in general practice, repeat on the platform what is available in books. The examination of these objections of Rackham is done in some detail in the little book, The Oracles of God. If you want to study these objections and see the explanation and see how the key that we claim to have been using to unlock Luke's record of these speeches turns back what are regarded as objections into really vindications of the truth of the record and make clear the argument of Stephen. Are there now any questions? There's only a minute or two because we've been rather long.